I'm moving now from the cold deserts of Antarctica to the Atacama Desert in northern Chile, which is one of the driest deserts on Earth. And I'm interested in the impacts of increasing aridity, which we're all looking at, on arid soil, on the arid soil microbiome. So again, the below ground microbial component of the ecosystem. And I want to begin with the concept of soil microbiome resistance, because if we argue that the microbial populations have a critical nutrient cycling capacity for their associated ecosystem, we need to think about the resilience, which is really what we've been talking about this whole session. So we have an original soil microbiome, and it's pretty well accepted that there are constant temporary disturbances that alter the structure of that microbiome slightly. Drying and wetting events, freeze-thaw events, the kind of things that Egbert was just modeling for us. But the assumption is that the ecosystem capacity of that microbiome is retained and that it will revert to its original structure as soon as that cycle ends or that cycle returns to its form. But what happens when we have a prolonged disturbance, which is the kind of thing that Jane was modeling with extended warmer temperatures, drought, agriculture, Jeff talked about when you have overgrazing. What does that do to the microbiome? If it becomes depleted, does it lose its ecosystem capacity? And if it does, then what is required? Will it naturally at some point, if you remove the disturbance, return to its original structure, or will some kind of rehabilitation be required? And then one question that interests me is, can we pass into a point of no return? Can we dry out a system? When we remove that biological crust, and we're actually interested in the microbes below the crust, we've disturbed them that much, do they come to a point of lack of ability to function? So I am using the Atacama Desert as a location to study the processes or the disturbance of extreme aridity. And the Atacama is great because you have this wonderful precipitation gradient starting on the western coast of the Pacific and moving up into the Andes. And that's because you have this really cold north flowing current, the Humboldt Current, along the coast of Chile, which prevents evaporation off the Pacific. And any water that does evaporate into coastal fogs really doesn't make it up into the central desert because of a steep coastal mountain range. And you also have a rain shadow, an extreme rain shower effect, because the Andes are about 18,000 feet high, so the water carried off the Atlantic Ocean with the trade winds pretty much rains out in Argentina on the eastern side of the Andes, and very little rainfall passes into the Atacama. But what we end up with is this great precipitation gradient from virtually nothing in the central desert up into some annual precipitation that happens in the Andes. So that's the site that we've been studying for the last 10 years. And so as I said, you have a precipitation gradient on the western side of the desert of about zero. It rains maybe once every 10 to 100 years. And then you move up to about 100 millimeters, 120 millimeters precipitation in the Andes. And that also occurs over a 800 to 5,000 meter elevation gradient. And I'm not going to go over a lot of the details of the different experiments we've run, but I just stuck our publication up there, which came out earlier this year, if you're interested in specific details. Basically, we monitored the microbial populations using sequencing of the 16S genes, bacteria and archaea. For soils, we looked at the pH, electrical conductivity, organic carbon, plant cover, soil nitrates, soil sulfates. And importantly, we installed soil data loggers that measured relative humidity and temperature, and they were there in place for 3 years, measuring every 2 hours. So we have a pretty cool soil moisture record from that time period. We didn't see soil crusts in this part of the desert, so I'd like to talk to Jane at the end, if we have time, about why we don't see biological crusts in this central part of the Atacama Desert. Our data analysis allowed us to group our sites into three what we call aridity classes. The hyperarid areas outlined in brown represent areas that had significant nitrate and sulfate accumulation in the surface layers. And nitrates are very soluble salts, so if they accumulate, they show you that over geologic time there's very little or any precipitation going on. Also, no plants in this area at all. There haven't been plants in this area probably for several million years. In the blue, we have what we call the margin, which is regions with no perennial plants and also no salt accumulation in the soil profile. And up there in green is what we call the arid, where there are perennial plants. And unfortunately, I didn't put a picture in my presentation, because I saw all Jane's great pictures. I thought the vegetation cover at the highest extent is about 8 to 9%. And there's no trees. So we have shrubs, Atraplex and Breath at up around 4,000 meters, 3,000 meters and above. So we looked at a couple of diversity indices to see what's the impact. Along the x-axis, we have relative humidity. So that soil relative humidity averaged over 3 years gave us a gradient from 20%, which is really, really dry, to 100% soil average soil relative humidity. And as you can see, there is a very strong correlation between both richness and the evenness of microbial distributions across that gradient of relative humidity. We also saw a much larger gradient in phylogenetic distribution of populations than I expected. And so we did what we call a best analysis to try to look at which of the 12 factors that we measured in our study could explain this large gradient in phylogenetic distribution that we saw. And this top row on the table shows you that five factors gave us the strongest correlation to explain the variance in microbial phylogenetic composition. E is elevation, which is really another way of saying our site location, because every location was at a different elevation. So basically, microbial populations sampled from the same site were more similar to each other than to any other site. EC is electrical conductivity. Salts were higher, as you can imagine, in the hyper-arid regions where you get little rainfall. And then the next three parameters are things from the data loggers that are directly related to increasing aridity. So average soil relative humidity, high soil relative humidity, which we defined as over a 7 day period, what's the highest relative humidity that site got to? And the same was true for temperature. So those were the factors that most influenced our phylogenetic distribution. So what this showed us, now I have to say we're not looking at, I called it increasing aridity, but really these are stable sites that have probably been at the same aridity class for many, many years. But it shows the impact of aridity has a very significant effect on diversity and phylogenetic composition. Now we all know that microbes interact together to accomplish their ecosystem function. And so we use network analysis, which, who's familiar with network analysis? Okay, a couple of you. So I won't go through the 101 version of this slide, but ask questions if you want. Network analysis shows co-occurrence between populations. So we wanted to look at, does this loss in diversity and this drastic change in phylogenetic composition influence the way these communities are possibly related? And basically what we learned in this diagram, the dots are yellow each dot is an OTU. Each vector or gray line is a co-occurrence between OTUs. If they're yellow, they're more frequently found in the high relative humidity areas, and if they're brown, they're in the low relative humidity areas. So what we saw from this analysis is first, 99% of the correlations were positive, which tells us that the microbes in these systems are responding to similar environmental factors. And as you've probably already seen, the more dense part of the network is populated by yellow nodes, or microbes that are more commonly found in the moister areas. And these weird protrusions off the bottom that you don't typically see in network analysis are all populated by brown nodes, or brown OTUs, typical of the hyper-arid site. And there are some statistics, some metrics that you can measure from networks. And both of these, the node degree and the edge count, are metrics that describe the individual nodes or OTUs. And they are extremely strongly correlated with relative humidity. The node degree describes how many other OTUs correlate with a particular OTU. So if its node degree is high, then you can think of a spoke in a wheel. There are a whole lot of spokes coming in. It has a relative abundance. It correlates with a lot more OTUs. And the size of these dots on this plot are node degree. Edge count is just the number of co-occurrences. So then we wanted to ask, well, we had this conclusion. Communities and regions of higher soil relative humidity contain more OTUs with correlated relative abundances than communities in drier areas. So we wanted to say, okay, let's break this network up into our three aridity classes. And let's see what the network looks like if we do that. Well, this is what we ended up with. There, the arid region where there's plants had your basically a well-integrated network. But as you move from margin to hyper-arid, you can see that that network seems to disintegrate. And the margin area, we call this the bridge and island effect, because you have a few nodes that are forming bridges that are connecting these clusters. But when you get down to the hyper-arid community, it all starts to fall apart, and you just have what we call a lack of cohesion, and you have an island effect. So we immediately want to say, what does this network analysis tell us about the functional capacity of the community, or the community in general? And the first thing we have to look at is, you could argue that this disintegration of cohesion is just an artifact of the loss of diversity. Because if you have a whole lot fewer OTUs, then they're just not going to be networked together. So I say we, but this network work was done by Cesar Cardona, who's a graduate student with Jack Gilbert at the University of Chicago. So the big we is Cesar. He did this network simulation in which he took the hyper-arid, the size of the hyper-arid community, and he randomized the arid and margin community so that they would have the same OTU number. So the scores on the top of this table are the original scores from the full network, and the scores on the bottom of the table are from the simulated network. So now you can see that degree that I talked about that correlated strongly with relative humidity. It's now the same for all of them. So yes, in fact, degree is related to size. But there's two other metrics that we can look at. One is the average path length. And that these are what we call global metrics. They're metrics that allow you to look at, to quantify the cohesion of a network. The average path length is, for the whole network, what's the distance between OTUs, that path, that vector between OTUs. And if you get that bridge effect, you're going to have a much longer average path length. And as you can see, the hyper-arid network has a much higher average path length than the arid and margin network. So what that tells us is that even when you normalize the communities to the same size, still the arid network is much more cohesive with a whole lot more interactions. And this is just another way, it's also a global metric, the between the centralization. What that, the between this value is, how many times does an OTU function as a bridge between two other OTUs, connecting two other OTUs. And if you think of this sort of island bridge hub effect, oftentimes an OTU is a hub between two islands. And if that happens, it gets a very high between this value. So if you have that kind of structure, you end up with a really high between the centralization. So both of these metrics tell us that, yes, in fact, what we were seeing, that we can put a number on it and say that when you get to the hyper-arid community, you've lost cohesion. And the last thing is edge count. And edge count is just the number of times you have an interaction between two OTUs. And you can see that even when we normalize for community size, we have a higher edge count in the arid and margin communities than we do in the hyper-arid. So our conclusion is that increasing aridity correlates with a decrease in connectivity of the arid soil microbiome. This is what it looks like in the hyper-arid region of the desert. Not a bit of life evident there, you would think. Above-ground life, I should say. But there is below-ground life, and so the question I have now is, how does this observation that we have a decrease in diversity, we have a very altered phylogenetic composition, and we have this loss of community connectivity, how does that fit into this paradigm of depleted microbiome versus threshold of irreversibility? So what we want to do is take a quick look. These are the five hyper-arid regions, and it's just a heat map of the OTUs that have abundances of 5% or more. And what you can see is the communities are different, and also they, and this is very interesting looking at Egbert's data, they are populated by actinobacteria, the orange, Dermatomonadides is the blue, and gamma proteobacteria is the green. And they are very uneven. They have single OTUs with 20 to 45% abundance, which is very strange. So the next, we took two with different profiles, and working with a collaborator in Chile, Cecilia Demargasso, she did a simulated rainfall experiment. And the top curves, the blue and the red, so I should probably integrate SIP into this, but this is just wetting up and using quantitative PCR to measure your bacterial numbers and your archaea numbers. The top two curves are bacteria, and we got a greater than one log increase over 30 days by just creating a supplying 5% gravimetric water. This was not done in the field. This was done in the lab to simulate the field conditions. The archaea were kind of weird. There were some blips, but they generally decreased. So some people have argued that archaea are more prevalent under extreme conditions, but it's the bacteria that responded. And right now what we are doing is sequencing each of these time points to try to figure out which of the organisms may have responded to this wetting event. So that these organisms, so the conclusion is these organisms are alive. They, we don't yet know what they're doing, but they are not a completely dysfunctional community. It's not just relic DNA, and a number of people would argue that most of the DNA in extreme deserts is relic. So we're fascinated to try to explore this to find out who it is that can live under these conditions and whether we have autotrophs and nitrogen fixers that are just unknown populations. So I just want to thank my co-authors and collaborators. And there were a lot of people working with us in the Atacama and the funding sources. So thank you. I'm pretty sure I've used up my time.